Let's get to our guest, James Corbett, who's calling in from Japan. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report, which you can find at CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. He's the editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. Hello, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you guys doing today?
Just fine.
Oh, just fine. Thank you, James.
Yep. Well, where are we going to go today, Jim? What do you think is important in the news that people should know about that maybe they haven't heard yet?
Well, I don't know about the news, but I myself have been working on a new feature-length documentary that I just released on Sunday that I hope people will check out if they haven't done so already. It's called The Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve, and I spent 7 months putting that together, so I've put an awful lot of work into it, and I think it's pretty relevant to what's going on today with the bubble insanity that we see spreading throughout the markets as, well, primarily as a result of the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing insanity. So hopefully it will get more people questioning the Federal Reserve system, and hopefully with a little bit better understanding of what it is and how it's operating. Because, again, I think we have to know our enemy before we can effectively defeat it.
I agree. Solution to every problem begins with an accurate diagnosis. If you can't diagnose the problem, you certainly can't solve it, unless by dumb luck. We need an accurate diagnosis. Where do people find A Century of Enslavement?
It's available on YouTube. It's available on my website. The best link for people, CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve. That has the YouTube link. It also has the complete transcript with sources. It has some other resources like a downloadable flyer that you can use to print off and get the word out to other people. And of course, there's a DVD copy for sale if you want to, but it's 100% freely available online.
All right. Sounds good. We'll take a look. Got an article here from Christian Science Monitor. The headline is, "With Ukraine Rebels on the Ropes, Some Russians Ask, Where is Putin?" And what they're complaining about, what they're concerned about, is it appears that the Ukrainian rebels, who were doing very well and showed the Ukrainian government military to be weak, disorganized, Now the tide is turning against the rebels, and where is Putin, who was allegedly prepared to invade? Do you have any insight into that?
Well, I think the key word there is allegedly. And the question is, Do we really believe that Putin was willing to go into a military scenario for the purposes of the people there in eastern Ukraine? And I'm not convinced that that was something that was seriously being considered, because I don't think that direct military confrontation with Ukraine is going to be in the best interests of Russia and Putin's particular plan for what's going on there. I think certainly covert support and aid to what's happening in eastern Ukraine is certainly on has been happening and will presumably continue to happen, but I don't think that he's really ready or willing to put this to the military confrontation.
But if he doesn't do that, what will that do to his own credibility in Russia, for example? I assume that the people in Russia believed his apparent promise that he'd back up the Russians that were in Ukraine, he'd help them, and if push came to shove, what's it do for his credibility with the Russian people? What's it do with his own credibility with the international community? Is he beginning to emulate Obama, who draws red lines in the sand, and then he draws another red line, and then another red line?
Did he draw a red line on this?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's the question, because I don't recall any specific
Syria.
I don't recall any specific thing that he said that he was going to use military force if there was X, Y, or Z.
No,
happened.
But he said that if things happen in Syria beyond a certain point, he said, well, we'd react to that and we'd do whatever we thought we had to do. And it may not be that he said military, but regardless, he's drawing lines in the sand. And here we have Vladimir Putin, who seemed to be strong and powerful and the rest of this sort of thing. And he was saying, look, if anything happens, these Russian people will defend him. No, well, maybe not.
When it comes to the question, I guess, of his credibility and political viability in all of this, I think we have to look at the situation there internally in Russia and where his political base is and whether they would be swayed away from him as a result of this. And I don't think that that is the case, because I think the political base that he's playing to these days, I don't think it's the same base that he was playing to when he first came into power back in 99. But certainly these days, I think his political base is the nationalist, populist, rural population of Russia, rather than sort of the metropolitan type of upper crust, I guess, that was really more in his favor in the early years. And I think in that regard, I think he's probably still handily in the public's favor over his opponents, playing to that base that will continue to support him. I suppose we do have to see how this will ultimately end. And I suppose if the Eastern Ukrainian resistance is completely squashed out of existence and there are more massacres and nothing happens, he could certainly risk losing that support. But at this point, I just don't see that there's anyone on the Russian political horizon who's attempting to battle him in that particular terrain in terms of that demographic.
Mm-hmm. I've got an article here from SOT.net. Putin's speech to Russian diplomats. The time of U.S. world domination has ended. This is Putin's remark back in the last, I guess, on the 3rd of July. So within the last week. This week in Moscow, President Vladimir Putin made a major foreign policy statement. And in the course of it, he said that essentially, the world domination by the United States has ended, or at least that time has ended. Do you agree that world domination by the United States has ended? Is it merely diminished? Is it going to continue? Not as strong, but still predominant in the foreseeable future?
I would say it's ending. I think that there's a lot of different signs of that. Others would argue that what we're seeing right now is basically a part of a historical cyclical pattern that we see, the sort of U.S. retrenchment that happens after every major sort of foreign interventionist streak. So after World War II, after Korea, after Vietnam, we saw periods in which the U.S. became less willing to sort of go out there in an interventionist sense. And of course, within a few years, that would always return. So I think that people like David Rothkopf, for example, was recently arguing this in Foreign Policy, talking about how this is just a period of sort of recalibration. And we can imagine that the next president will almost certainly be sort of back to the usual standards of sort of American policemen of the world. I'm quite skeptical that America has the ability to wield that same type of power that it did at the height of its empire, certainly, you know, at the end of the Cold War. And I think, again, there's a lot of different reasons for that. And I think this goes back to Putin and the game that he's playing, which, again, I mean, I don't think direct military confrontation plays into that game at all for him right now. I think that it's more the types of things that aren't making headlines, but probably should be, like something that I wrote about in the Forecaster a few weeks ago, the fact that Russia and China, as well as actually America, has there's an American company that has a partnership in this, but Russia and China specifically are starting a new international credit rating agency, which is, I think, a pretty significant thing, because, of course, the big three credit rating agencies in the United States, S&P, Moody's, and the other one, whose name I'm going to forget off the top of my head, are the ones that have basically a stranglehold on valuation of debt internationally. And, of course, we know how that plays out. For example, in just earlier this year, I believe it was S&P downgraded Russia's sovereign debt, because they're saying, oh, all these sanctions are going to hurt the Russian economy, let's downgrade them. And, you know, Russia was just incensed by that. And they said, you know, if this continues, we're going to have to react by withdrawing our dollar holdings from not only the United States, but, you know, NATO-friendly countries, and all of these things that they said they were going to do in reaction to this. But I think the most significant is partnering with a Chinese firm. There's a Russian firm partnering with a Chinese firm that also has an American firm, Egan Jones, as a junior partner. And they are starting a new international credit rating agency, so that presumably after they, you know, build up their market, it will take years to reach the point at which they would have that type of influence. But they themselves would be able to downgrade the United States sovereign debt rating or that type of thing as a type of political maneuver. Because ultimately, I mean, credit rating agencies are being used for political purposes these days, as well as, of course, their financial manipulation type purposes, which we saw them used in the 2000 to 2008 bubble period.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break here in a couple of moments for some commercial announcements. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the Federal Reserve and see if you can give us some more insight into what we can expect when we view the century of enslavement. The result is 7 months of your work. And let's do that. Let's take that break now, and we'll be right back and talk about the century of enslavement. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett of The Corbett Report. James has spent 7 months preparing a video entitled The Century of Enslavement, dealing with the Federal Reserve System. And James, why don't you give us an outline of what we can expect in your video?
Well, it's a 90-minute documentary, and it's split into three parts. And the first part deals with the economic history specifically of the United States, although it does go back to the founding of the Bank of England in 1694. And it takes us through that period of history from basically the founding of the country in the late 1700s through to the creation of the Federal Reserve, although it's certainly not a comprehensive overview of that history, but it certainly hits on the central banks that had been tried in the United States up until that point, the Bank of North America, the First Bank of the United States, and the Second Bank of the United States, all precedents to the Federal Reserve, which of course was created on December 23rd, 1913, when President Wilson signed it into law. The second part of the documentary then picks up the story of, well, what is the Federal Reserve? How does it operate? In whose interest does it operate? What does it actually do? And then the third part is solutions. So where do we go from here? What can we do about this system? Why should we do something about this system? And ultimately, what are we going to do about it? So that's the way it's broken up. And again, I know there's a lot of people probably in your audience who are already familiar with things about the Federal Reserve. I mean, one of those things that the alternative media has popularized, for example, is the phrase like the Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express. We've heard things like that and similar catchphrases that have been circulating for a number of years. A lot of people think they already know about the Federal Reserve and this type of subject matter. But I think there's still a lot more to know about the specifics of how it functions. And as we said before, if we don't really understand how it functions, we can't really effectively combat it. So I hope, if anything, that this adds a little bit more understanding to the specifics of how the Fed functions.
you're talking about the title of the video is The Century of Enslavement, and you're also referring to how we can combat the Federal Reserve. And the clear implication is that you don't believe the Federal Reserve has been helping this country. It's been working to our disadvantage. So why don't you give us a little idea, is enslavement what you really mean, or is it a little bit of hyperbole? How have we been enslaved by the Federal Reserve?
Well, I understand the misgivings that people might have with that title, and I'm not insensitive to them. Excuse me. But I don't think that it's certainly not meant as hyperbole. It's meant in a descriptive sense, because I think we have to have a very, very realistic understanding of the fact that the monetary system itself is the basis for all economic transaction in our society. And it not only determines the economy in some sort of vague sense, it determines how we live our lives. It determines what we do with our lives. We spend our entire lives chasing after, lusting after, fighting for, sometimes killing for, dying for these pieces of paper. And sometimes not even these pieces of paper. In fact, the majority of our transactions, not pieces of paper, but digits on a computer screen, that somehow to us represent value and wealth. And yet, the vast majority of people out there have no idea what this money is, where it comes from, how it is created, how it is destroyed, who controls that process. And that, to me, is a very frightening form of enslavement, because literally people are devoting their entire lives to a system that they don't understand, and their lives are being determined by it. People are working in the system, and as I say, fighting and dying for it without even understanding how it works. And that, to me, is in some ways an even more insidious form of enslavement than simply indentured physical servitude, where somebody, you can see there's a master with a whip who's making someone do something. That, in a way, I mean, it's easy to identify what's happening and easy to understand what is morally wrong with it. It is much more difficult to understand what's wrong with a system in which we are being economically determined from our birth, from before our birth, by a system that's been instituted in a way that most people don't even understand what it is.
We had John Maynard Keynes in his book, The Economic Consequences of Peace, 1919, there's a section in there where he says, he's talking about the monetary system, and I can't quote him precisely, but he says he's talking, it is so difficult to understand that he claimed that not one man in a million could understand that system well enough to diagnose what the problems are. And that makes us all extremely vulnerable. This mass ignorance makes us subject, one man in a million. I don't think he was kidding. We had Henry Ford came out at one point, and he said, it's a good thing that the people don't understand the monetary system, because if they did, there'd be a revolution by morning. And what that implies is Ford understood the monetary system, and he understood that it was contrary to the best interests of the people. And he was essentially saying, look, it's a good thing they don't know, we'd have revolution. So these two statements illustrate the enormous ignorance on the part of virtually everyone. One man in a million. Today it might only be, today with education and the internet, one thing and another, we might say that one man in 10,000, even one in 1,000 is all that really understand the monetary system. But that still means 99.9% of the people of this country, they don't understand anything more about money other than how to count it, how to spend it, maybe.
Sadly, unfortunately, that's correct. And just to add weight to what Henry Ford was saying, I think, again, it's not hyperbole to say that this is a revolutionary type of knowledge, because when you actually, again, when you look at the history, and unfortunately, this was something that was in the first draft of my script for the documentary that ultimately I didn't end up having time for, as I was really trying to keep it to 90 minutes. But when you look back at the pre-United States, at the colonial times, and you look at the different monetary systems that they were trying out, various colonial script systems that were sometimes wildly successful, sometimes wildly unsuccessful, but that was a way of trying to find some sort of economic independence from the crown before the Revolutionary War even started. There are people like Benjamin Franklin who really believe that one of the prime contributing factors to the Revolutionary War was the British manipulation of the money, and basically trying to determine what money could be used in the United States, and of course making gold be that money that everyone had to use because it benefited the crown. But there was these colonial scripts going around that questioned that system, and of course there was the attempt by the British to squash that out. This was one of the impetuses for the Revolutionary War itself, according to people like Franklin. And I think, again, if people understood the way that the monetary system is used and manipulated to keep people oppressed and to keep them using these Federal Reserve notes now in our current paradigm, rather than exploring different monetary systems that could exist and ways that we could enable people to transact freely and actually unlock the productive potential of humanity for the future. If people really understood that, I really do think that would be a revolutionary thing. And to a certain extent, I think we've seen it in recent years with the idea of End the Fed becoming, I think, that sort of revolutionary chant, that slogan. And it has to become more than a slogan. I think people, again, have to have a better knowledge of what it is they're trying to end. But still, I think it is the possibility for a revolutionary movement.
You know, it is interesting. We've got a slogan, End the Fed. 10 years ago, it might have been, what's the Fed? If you catch my drift, what's the Federal Reserve? People didn't even understand. Now they're aware that there's a problem, but we are still in the diagnostic stage where we're trying to figure out what is the problem. If we've been enslaved by the Federal Reserve, who are the slave masters? If I'm a slave, who is the master?
Well, ultimately, I think we have to look at who created the system. And again, this is not really a controversial point. In fact, it was a conspiracy. This is not conspiracy theory. This is conspiracy fact, as proven by the conspirators themselves, specifically Frank Vanderlip, who on the February 1935 edition of the Saturday Evening Post that is available online and is linked in the transcript for my documentary there at corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve, he wrote at great length about a secret meeting that he was engaged in 1910. And this meeting came about as a result of something called the Panic of 1907. It was a tragic, horrific banking panic that swept through the banking establishment, specifically in New York, but had implications for the entire country. where basically we looked at something similar to, I guess, what we saw in 2008, the possibility of the collapse of the financial system itself. And J.P. Morgan came along to save everybody, according to the official history. The unofficial history is that he actually caused the banking panic. But anyway, this caused a great consternation among the public, and suddenly monetary reform and the monetary issue became the number one issue in the country. It started a congressional commission into this. There was the Pujo Committee that looked at the money trust, what was called the money trust, that identified three banks that basically controlled the entire nation's system of credit and currency. And something had to be done about this. What are we going to do about it? So in 1910, there was a secret meeting that was talked about again by Frank Vanderlip. He admitted to it 25 years later, of people like Vanderlip, who was associated, I believe, with National City Bank, one of those types of large banks at the time. He was in cahoots on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia with people like A. Pyatt Andrew, the Treasury Secretary at the time, Senator Nelson Aldrich, who, of course, was eventually a father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller Jr. and was intimately connected with the banking establishment. People like Harry Davison, I believe he was of National City Bank, and various Morgan-connected people like Benjamin Strong Jr. and others. They met on Jekyll Island in complete secrecy in 1910 to work out basically the draft of what became known as the Aldrich Plan, which was the first attempt at putting together a central bank like what eventually became the Federal Reserve. And again, it's more effective if you read this in Frank Vanderlip's own words, but he said, I was as furtive as any conspirator. We knew that we could not be found out in our plan that to create this Aldrich plan, because if the public knew where this was coming from, they would surely reject it. So we had to be completely secretive. And what we came up with was what became the Federal Reserve. The Aldrich plan was ultimately voted down because people were concerned about Aldrich and his connections, but it was given a few facelifts and then put forward by some other legislators and was passed in 1913. So it was the result of a conspiracy, particularly by the major bankers, and I would say J.P. Morgan was really the number one interest behind that, but certainly there were a lot of banking interests that colluded on this, and the point that G. Edward Griffin makes in my documentary is that this was a cartel. It was a cartel of banking interests that knew the public wanted some sort of legislation, some sort of regulation of their industry, so rather than twiddling their thumbs and crossing their fingers and hoping everything would work out for them, they went ahead of that and they created their own regulatory system, which of course became the Federal Reserve System. So it's a banking cartel run by the banks for the banks' interests, and it continues to be so today. And it is a people talk about it being a privately owned central bank. It's more confusing than that, deliberately so, I think. There are public aspects to it. The Board of Governors, for example, appointed by the president. The Federal Open Market Committee consists of the Board of Governors and presidents of the Federal Reserve Banks, which are absolutely, admittedly, on the record, private banks held by private shareholders, which are the member banks of the Federal Reserve System. So the banks own the Federal Reserve Banks that make an important part of the Federal Open Market Committee that determines interest rates. So this is, again, it's a banking cartel that operates in banking cartel's interests for the benefit of the bankers. These are the people who are in control of this system.
When we say they're in control of this system, are we talking about the bankers are in control of the banking system? Are we talking about the bankers are in control of the government? Who is running who? Does the Federal Reserve run the government? Does the government run the Federal Reserve, or to what extent?
I think it's more nuanced than that, mm-hmm. at least in terms of a, you know, billiard ball cause and effect type relationship. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the Federal Reserve System itself, I mean, the bankers are in control of monetary policy, basically. I mean, that's the way that plays out. So that the Federal Open Market Committee, as I said, for example, determines the Federal Reserve's transactions in terms of buying and selling government securities, which regulates the amount of money in the system for the banks to play with, which then becomes money by lending, et cetera, et cetera. So they, in effect, I mean, it's not a direct control, but they have the levers to basically increase or decrease money in the system, which is the control over the money supply itself. That is what the Federal Reserve really does. It's control over the money supply. That, of course, has political ramifications. If you have control over the money supply, then you obviously have a great degree of political clout that can and should, and according to the interest behind them, be used to sort of flex political muscles and create a system where people are beholden to the money that you're creating. And I mean, obviously that brings with it the political benefits. Again, it's not a direct cause and effect relationship, but I think it's quite obvious that, and this
it's
is
great influence. It might not be exactly cause, but it is great influence. You know, it's the ball's on the table. You don't hit it with a cue ball, but still you go close to it, and it still moves. Not exactly cause and effect, but...
This is usually summed up by a quotation that's attributed to Mayor Amschel Rothschild, which, I mean, I don't know if there's any source that actually backs this up, but I think the idea contained in the quotation is true, which is, give me the ability to issue a nation's currency, and I care not who writes its laws. I think that's sort of the underlying principle that we're looking at.
I've got I knew a man by the name of Terry Lofton back in the 1990s. He collected a lot of books on legal reform, law books and whatever. And in the process, he went to estate sales. And on one occasion, he picked up a 3-volume set of the operations manual for the Federal Reserve from some wealthy man who died. Now, they were just selling this stuff off. The heirs just wanted to get the money. They didn't care what anything was. Lofton read those 3 volumes, and one of the things that he told me is that the Federal Reserve policy was that they would not encourage any loans to alternative energy. If you came in from oil, if you came in from nuclear, if you came in from coal, you could get loans. If you came in from, if you wanted wind power or solar energy, and this goes back in the 1980s and 1990s, no loans so far as the Federal Reserve. The point was they were influencing economic policy and innovation simply by deciding who would have easy access to credit and who would not. And so some industries simply didn't flourish that might otherwise have done so. We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm Alfred Addis, here with Jim Corbett of the Corbett Report. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival. My guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We've been talking about James' recent video, just recently posted, entitled The Century of Enslavement, after 7 months of work. And James explained that the video is broken down into 3 sections, one dealing with the history of the Federal Reserve. That's the focus. Federal Reserve is the focus. First, dealt with the history. Second, whose interests? Who's really running the show? We talked about that a little bit. And the third section is solutions. Is it premature to start talking about solutions, or can we start on that now?
It's never premature for that, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Go ahead.
So I should go ahead. All right. Well, the third part of this starts with the observation that ultimately, once you understand this system and what it's really about, the conclusion that we arrive at is that this is not about money. Again, the money that is being created in the system, the vast majority of it is being created by private banks as loans, as debt. That is issued to the public and is... It's sometimes said that this money is created out of nothing via the charter that's granted to these banks via the fractional reserve banking system that the Federal Reserve undergirds. That's, in a way, that's true. But I think more to the point, this money is created not out of nothing, not out of thin air, but out on the back of the promise of the individual to repay that loan at interest, of course, to the banks, which is a wonderful system if you happen to be a bank with that power to create that money that, again, you get paid back to you with interest simply for the virtue of being a bank. But that's obviously a system that's weighted in favor of the banks and against everyone else who ultimately has to become indebted to banks for money to even exist in the economy, which is a again, a pretty strange way to run an economy when you think about it. Now, there are reasons that this is developed, but the question is, can we do better than this? Can we come up with a system in which we don't have to think about being enslaved to banks in order for money to exist? And of course, there are many, many, many examples of systems that have been proposed and attempted and are still continuing to be successful experiments in various places of ways that people are going around this. So three that we look at specifically, first we highlight Ellen Brown talking about the state banks, including, of course, the Bank of North Dakota, which operates by providing free liquidity to banks in the state banking system there in North Dakota. We look at Paul Glover, who founded something called Ithaca Hours, which was a let's currency, a let's system in Ithaca, New York, in which the currency that he created was denominated in hours of work, and an hour was equivalent to about $10, which at the time that it was created was about double the national, about double the minimum wage. And so it's a mutual credit system where people basically pledge their work, their actual productive work, into that system in return for these hours, which they use as currency. So that's a let's system. And the third one that we take a look at is Roger Ver talking about Bitcoin. And it is not my intention with this documentary to say that any one of these proposals is going to be the definitive one, or that these are the only proposals that exist. And I go through some more, just mentioning them by name after that point, including one that I particularly am a fan of called self-issued credit, which is an idea from Paul Grignon, who is a Canadian, who created the Money as Debt series, a documentary series that I highly recommend for anyone who hasn't watched it. A lot of people did watch the first edition of that series. Not nearly so many have watched the second or third editions, which go into a lot of depth and start to get into this idea of self-issued credit. And the ultimate idea behind this is that, well, it's not an inherently bad thing to have a system in which money is created through credit, because that responds to the productive needs of the economy. If people need money, they can create the credit that creates the money. So it's not dependent on, for example, mining something out of the ground, which, you know, if we can't mine enough of yellow stuff out of the ground, then people die of starvation. It makes no sense. So it's a system that relies on credit, but instead of going to the banks to say, you know, we will pledge ourselves in service to you for the next 10, 20, 30, whatever years in order to get this mortgage or what have you, it's a system in which we create that credit ourselves. And it's, I know that sounds like a crazy idea. There's an awful lot behind it. So I would just, once again, hope people would go and take a look at the Money as Debt series to really start exploring that idea. But that's one of the ideas that are out there. And as I say, really what this documentary is hoping to do is broach this conversation and open it up. I'm not trying to say definitively that this or that solution is going to be the solution, but that basically any one of these systems that are being proposed would be better than the current system we have. And isn't it strange how this is truly one of the central issues that defines our entire lives, and yet this idea of monetary reform and taking a look at the money supply and how it's created and what currency is completely excluded from our education, so that most people have no idea what a Federal Reserve note is or why it is called that. And so I'm just hoping to broach this conversation and hopefully get people thinking about the solutions that we could start implementing.
Ignorance makes it a lot easier to control people if they don't understand what's going on in there. And it's almost astonishing. And one of the frustrations that I would bet you have encountered is trying to deal with a subject of this importance, and yet it's almost like you have to feel like Dr. Doolittle, you know, if you could talk to the animals. How do you get people to understand this? The ignorance is so pervasive. It's almost like you have to take people and start them with A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and how to sound out the words. And you almost have to take them back to kindergarten. And it should be something that we can speak to people who've graduated from high school and certainly graduated from college. And there should be common ground here. Yeah, I get that. You're working with profound ignorance on the part of your audience. How do you deal with it?
Well, I certainly agree with what you're saying, but I guess perhaps I'm just wired differently. I'm not sure I see that as a frustration so much as an opportunity. And I'm certainly not going to claim that I'm the best communicator of this, but I find that when you do start to break it down to that level and you start to explain to people in very simple terms that your money is being created as debt owed to the banks and in a system that was created by the banks for the banks, and it's a banker system. Once you start to break that down and really show people how that works, people really are motivated by this issue. And I mean, just as one example, this is a 90-minute documentary about economics and central bank history and very what's considered, of course, we're taught this is so boring, you know, who cares about economics, even though it is central to our lives. But this 90-minute documentary, it's been up for 4 days now. It has almost 50,000 views on YouTube. It's getting posted all around the web. I couldn't have asked for a better response to this. A lot of people are really passionately motivated and interested in this subject when it is put in a way that shows what is at stake. But that's exactly the point. I mean, we've been told all our lives, as I say, that this is boring, dry stuff. Who cares about economics? Look at all this jargon. When you strip that away, people understand it and start to respond to it. And to me, that's really exciting.
Then when you're saying that people are ready to listen.
I believe
so. If someone
so.
Can communicate, so. People are ready. This is an idea whose time has come.
I think it's already came. I think one of the points that I make at the start of the documentary is that our ignorance of economics is not natural. It has to be sort of educated into us. Because as children, we are born naturally inquisitive about the world. We want to know about the world and how it works. And so there's the childlike question, where does money come from? And there's a standard pat childlike response that's meant as a joke. It grows on trees. Ha ha ha. And that's meant to be that sort of thought stopper. And that's, you know, about the extent of our early childhood education on money. But and unfortunately, that level of ignorance more or less persists for most of our lives. But I don't think that real inquisitive nature ever really can be fully squelched. As long as the human spirit survives, people will be interested in these types of subjects. We'll want to know these types of things. And I really do have faith that when you start to put it in front of people in a way that makes sense to them, in a way that shows them the importance of it, of course people are going to respond to that. Who out there in the regular audience doesn't care about money and where it comes from? I mean, we all care about this because it is literally the difference between life and death, between having enough money to pay the rent and starve to death. And if there is someone out there saying, look, actually, if you look into this system, it's really been constructed to keep you on that treadmill your whole life. And there's a lot of potential to do things in a vastly different way that will have vastly different results. I think it's pretty obvious people are going to be interested in that.
Have you ever read the story of Joseph in the Old Testament, in Genesis, where Joseph is sent into slavery in Egypt, and they find out he can interpret dreams, and the Pharaoh has a dream that there are seven fat cows followed by seven skinny cows, and the skinny cows eat the seven fat cows, and then he has another dream, seven ripe shocks of wheat and that are consumed by seven emaciated shocks of wheat, and he interprets that dream and becomes a Pharaoh's right-hand man. And what the dream means is that there are going to be 7 years of abundance in Egypt, bumper crops, followed by 7 years of famine. And the way it was taught to me back when I attended Bible school as a child, they said, and Joseph, knowing what was going to happen, he built granaries and he stored all the extra grain during the 7 good years. So the people of Egypt would have grain during the 7 bad years, and he saved the country. That was the way the story was presented to me. But I actually read it back a few years ago. And you read it, it's back around chapter 41 or something like that in Genesis, this story of Joseph. And when the famine began in the first year, the Egyptian people came to Joseph and they said, sell us grain. He had the grain stored up in the granaries, and they said, sell us grain, and for why should we die? And Joseph sold them. It tells you right there, it's in the book. It tells you Joseph sold them to grain. He didn't give it to them. He sold it to them until they had paid all of their money for grain. And then he put all of the money in the Pharaoh's storehouse. And it says the money failed, meaning the money disappeared out of circulation. And now the people couldn't work their way out of the situation because they didn't have any real money. And the next year they came back in the famine and they said, we don't have any grain and or we can't, we're going to starve. And why should we die? And sell us more grain. And he said, I'll sell you more grain if you sell me your cattle. And they sold all of their cattle to Joseph and he gave it to the Pharaoh. And the third year they came back and they sold all of their land to the Pharaoh. And then ultimately they sold themselves into slavery to the Pharaoh. And this is what it says in the Bible. This is 3,000 years old. It is a formula for how one man, Joseph, could essentially take over and destroy an entire nation. Until Joseph got there, the people of Egypt were pretty free and prosperous. And then after he set up the system, well, the reason I bring this to your attention is this is a form of, they showed you how economic warfare is conducted, and the knowledge has been here for 3,000 years, and it's right there in Genesis if you care to read it. And yet, people don't pick up on this. This is news. You know, it's a strange thing, and if you haven't read the story of Joseph in the Old Testament, and especially where how he handles things after the onset of the famine, really ought to take a look at it. He cornered the market. He knew he had inside information. He knew there was going to be 7 bad years, and therefore he cornered the market on wheat. And by doing that, he put the whole people of Egypt into bondage. This is before the people of Egypt put the Jews into bondage. So it's quite an extraordinary story, and it's amazing to me. 3,000 years it's been there, and virtually no one understands. Mm. No one reads it. No one understands it. And it's part of the ignorance that we have to cope with. Where are we? We've got about 2 minutes left. Something you'd like to add right now, or shall I pop another question?
There's so much to say on this subject, and what you just said is one of those extremely profound truths that I think we need to be sort of more knowledgeable about in general. The fact that knowledge itself is a leverage, and again, through our ignorance, we can be put into slavery by people who know even just a little bit more. Just using that spread between our knowledge levels can be extremely effective in putting people into positions where they are basically forced into servitude one way or another. So I think that's something to consider when thinking about this documentary. And I just want to once again direct people to CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve for the documentary and also for the transcript, which I hope is a good resource. It has links to all of the documents and everything that I used to compile this, including an awful lot of the Federal Reserve's own PR and propaganda and website and various things that they put out, videos and documents and pamphlets in their own words explaining what they do, because I think, again, it's important to take a look at that and the fact that so much of this is out there in the open. So I've really tried to make this the best sort of resource that it can be for people to at least dip their toes into this subject. And so, again, it's all completely free up there on CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve.
What's your next project? Do you have one in mind, or are you going to rest for a little while here and catch your breath before you move on to the next one?
I would like to hibernate for a million years. I always have a million ideas. It's a question of which one am I going to pursue. And this documentary was so exhausting, at the end, I'm extremely proud of this. I've never worked harder on anything in my life, and I think it probably is my greatest accomplishment, but it's certainly a huge undertaking. So I'm not sure I'm ready to commit to another feature-length documentary, but of course I'm always working on my podcasts and interviews and videos on a regular basis, so I'll continue doing that in the meantime, and I certainly do have some ideas. I do still want to get a book out eventually, and I hope that will happen sooner rather than later, but that's another project that I have on the back burner.
All right. Well, Jim, we are out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. I want to thank you folks for listening. I want to remind you, Jim's recent video is The Century of Enslavement, which you can find at his website, the Corbett Report, or CorbettReport.com, or you can find it on YouTube. Take a look, take a listen. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody Cederstrom. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, James, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.